Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, Dorothy Gundy, Phil Dierking, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
The Pakistani television and film industry was shocked last month by accusations of sex abuse from a famous singer. Misha Shafi used the Twitter hashtag MeToo to accuse a male coworker of harassment. "Sharing this because I believe that by speaking out about my own experience of sexual harassment, I will break the culture of silence," she wrote. She added that such silence is found throughout Pakistani society. Shafi was not the first woman in Pakistan to use the hashtag or share her story. The Me Too movement that started in the United States had touched Pakistan already. However, most Pakistani women who have shared their experiences have hidden their identities. Shafi's act led to public dispute. Criticism of the singer became so severe that she suspended her Facebook and Instagram accounts. Shafi told the English language newspaper Dawn, "The abuse and threats that I have faced is the reason I felt the strong need to protect not just myself, but my family." She said she was worried for her two young children.
Fariha Altaf is a Pakistani businesswoman, social activist, and media star. She says she remembers facing a lot of sexual harassment when she was young, such as men touching her and believing it was normal. Women who protest sexual harassment in the office often are accused of dishonesty. "I don't think harassment is an issue anywhere. Women are lying when they say they are getting harassed," said Tufel Akhtar, a longtime film industry reporter. He also said that working women often use sex as a tool to move ahead in the business. He said Shafi must be speaking out because of a business dispute or professional jealousy. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Susan Shand.
Fish need insects for food. So, healthy rivers have healthy insect populations. However, in the United States, part of the Colorado River has an insect shortage that has left many fish without food. Researchers are hoping a month-long water flow experiment will improve the situation. The U.S. Geological Survey project involves the release of low, continuous water flow from Glen Canyon Dam. This will give insect eggs, which they lay just below the water's surface, a better chance to survive. The Colorado River runs 2,330 kilometers from the Rocky Mountains of Colorado to Lake Mead, on the border between the states of Arizona and Nevada. The Glen Canyon Dam is near the border between the states of Utah and Arizona. For whatever reason, downstream of Glen Canyon Dam really lacks diversity, said Scott Vanderkoy, who runs the U.S. Geological Survey's Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center in Flagstaff. Scientists expect a 26% increase in insects such as black flies and midges by next summer. Scientists say that when insect populations grow, so do the populations of other animals such as fish, bats, birds, and other insect eaters. Insects attach their eggs to hard surfaces such as rocks or wood on riversides. As water from dams rises and falls, the eggs can lose their cover and dry out. If they remain above the waterline for even an hour, they die, said Jeff Mulbauer, a research scientist with the Geological Survey. The water flows are part of a larger plan approved in late 2016 for operations at Glen Canyon Dam to improve fish life. The dam holds back Lake Powell. John Hamill, a volunteer with the organization Trout Unlimited, says the experiments will help explain the current situation of all the different river resources. Then, officials can make changes based on how the river ecosystem is changing. People often fish along a 25-kilometer run of the Colorado River below the dam. However, a lack of insects means some of the fish caught are smaller than normal. Hamill says this has caused a lot of people to fish in different places. It hasn't been a very dependable fishery, Hamill said. Ted Kennedy started working at the Geological Survey in 2002. He said at the time, scientists had noted the low number of flies and other insects throughout the Grand Canyon. Kennedy began studying the lives of insects before the hatch. He asked river guides and students for help studying the adult insect life as well. Since 2012, the volunteers have set out plastic containers for an hour each night. A special light is attached that leads the insects into the containers. The evidence from the containers showed researchers that fish in the area have a weak food source. This problem leads to fish that are longer, thinner, do not swim well, and do not have the energy to reproduce or fight. The U.S. Geological Survey scientist Ted Kennedy said, "When things are bad for midges, there's not much else to take its place." I'm Phil Dierking.
Google announced new features to make devices smarter and more useful to open its yearly Developers Conference. The announcements came at Google's I/O 2018 conference in Mountain View, California. We put together a list of 10 of the top new features. Most will be released soon or throughout the summer. All are powered by Google's ever-developing artificial intelligence, or AI, technology. One of the most talked-about events was when Google chief Sundar Pichai demonstrated how the company's digital assistant had set a haircut appointment for someone all by itself.
So what you're going to hear is the Google Assistant actually calling a real salon to schedule the appointment for you.
Hello, how can I help you?
Hi, I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure, give me 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real call you just heard.
Pichai said the demonstration was the result of the company's research and development over many years in the areas of natural language, deep learning, and text-to-speech. Google calls the technology Duplex. The idea is to create machines that sound and act more human-like in interactions with people. Pichai announced that 6 new voices are being added to Google Assistant, including one based on singing star John Legend.
John Legend's voice will be coming later this year so that you can get responses like this.
At 10 a.m., you have an event called Google I.O. Keynote. Then, at 1 p.m., you have margaritas. Have a wonderful day.
I'm looking forward to 1 p.m.
The company also announced that, by the end of 2018, Assistant will support 30 languages in 80 countries.
Google says it had received some reports that parents did not like the way their children sometimes spoke differently to the assistant than they would to them. So engineers designed a way for children to receive digital praise when they act politely.
Tell me a story, please.
Thanks for asking so nicely. You're very polite.
I know.
Another new feature related to Assistant is called Continued Conversation. Until now, users have had to say, "Hey, Google," each time they asked a question or wanted help. But now, a user can issue more than one command, such as a follow-up question, for up to 8 seconds, and Assistant will answer.
Google will now include augmented reality to help guide users. In Google Maps, people can look through the device camera and get turn-by-turn directions while viewing the actual street. The feature will also use local landmarks and buildings captured by the camera to help guide the trip. The latest new tool for Gmail is an autocomplete feature called Smart Compose. It uses AI to suggest ways to finish sentences as they are written. For example, "I haven't seen you" might be auto-completed to "I haven't seen you in a while, and I hope you're doing well."
Google says it recognizes many users are trying to find the right balance in life with technology. Sometimes they would like to break away from their devices to be able to spend time on better things. New features with this in mind can help users prevent overuse of technology. A dashboard will provide users detailed information about how much time they are spending on which parts of their device. When the device is placed face down, a new feature will put the device on hold and silence it so the user can center on other things. A wind-down mode feature can let users enter the time they want to go to bed. At that time, the device will again go silent, and the front of the device will dim to help users disconnect before bed.
There are several new changes to Google Photos. When one feature recognizes a photo of someone in a user's contact list, it can suggest sending the photo to that person. It can also change photos to PDF files and automatically add color to black and white photos, or make part of a color photo black and white. Google is redesigning its news presentation in a way it says will make it easier for users to keep up with the news they are most interested in. The Google News app will present 5 top stories, plus others it thinks will be of most interest to the user. A new feature is called Full Coverage, which Google says provides a complete picture of a single story from various sources and formats. Another is called Newscasts. This gives users a preview of a story and lets them decide where to go from there. Google engineer Tristan Upstill introduced the new tools.
Our AI constantly reads the fire hose of the web for you, the millions of articles, videos, podcasts, and comments being published every minute.
The Android P version of Google's Android operating system will include more powerful AI tools. One will let the battery learn over time how people use their apps and then adapt in an effort to save power. Adaptive brightness will learn and make changes in a similar way. It will learn from the level of brightness in the environment as well as settings changed by users over time. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. On December 10, 1898, the United States and Spain signed a treaty in Paris, officially ending the war between them. However, the fighting had stopped much earlier. Spain had made the first move toward peace after its forces surrendered at Santiago on the Cuban coast. A few weeks before that, the United States Navy had destroyed Spain's Atlantic fleet. The American naval victory ended any chance that Spain could win the war. Doug Johnson and Steve Ember continue the story of President William McKinley and the Spanish-American War.
Late in July, the French ambassador in Washington gave President William McKinley a message from the Spanish government. Spain asked what terms the United States would demand for peace. President McKinley sent an immediate answer. Spain, he said, must give up Cuba. It must also give to the United States the islands of Puerto Rico and Guam. And he said Spain must recognize the right of the United States to occupy Manila in the Philippines. The future of the Philippines, he said, would be decided during negotiations on a peace treaty.
McKinley's terms seemed severe to Spain, but Spain had no choice. It could not continue the war. So, 10 weeks after war broke out, Spain agreed to stop the fighting and accept the American terms. It signed a peace agreement in Washington on August 12th. A Spanish note protested sadly that the agreement took away the last memory of a glorious past. It expels us from the Western Hemisphere, which became peopled and civilized through the proud efforts of our fathers.
The two countries agreed to meet in Paris to negotiate details of a peace treaty. The talks opened October 1st. The two sides agreed quickly on the issue of Cuban independence and an American takeover of Puerto Rico and Guam. But they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. At the beginning of the talks, the United States was not sure if it wanted all or only part of the Philippines. At first, President McKinley wanted Spain to give up only Luzon, the main island. Then he decided that the United States should demand all of the Philippines. McKinley explained later how he made this decision.
I thought first we would take only Manila, then Luzon, then other islands, perhaps. I walked the floor of the White House many nights. More than once I went down on my knees and asked God to help me decide. And one night, said McKinley, it came to me this way, that we could not give the Philippines back to Spain. That would be cowardly and dishonorable. We could not turn them over to France or Germany, our trading competitors in Asia. That would be bad business. We could not leave them to themselves. They were not ready for self-government. So there was nothing for us to do but to take them all, and to educate the Filipinos, to civilize them, and make Christians of them. With that decision, said McKinley, I went to bed and slept well.
Spain, however, did not want to give up the Philippines. It protested that the United States had no right to demand the islands. True, Americans occupied Manila, but they did not control any other part of the Philippines. The two sides negotiated for days. Finally, they reached an agreement. Spain would give all of the Philippines to the United States. In return, the United States would pay Spain $20 million. With this dispute ended, the peace treaty was quickly completed and signed. But trouble developed when President McKinley sent the treaty to the United States Senate for approval.
Many Americans opposed the treaty. They thought McKinley was wrong to take the Philippines. Opponents of the treaty included former President Cleveland, industrialist Andrew Carnegie, labor leader Samuel Gompers, writer Mark Twain, and others. They organized anti-imperialist groups in many cities to oppose the treaty. They made speeches and published newspapers explaining their opposition. Imperialism, they said, had ruined ancient Rome, and it would ruin the American Republic. They said colonies halfway around the world would be costly to protect. A large army and navy would be needed. They said colonial policies violated important democratic ideas upon which the United States had been built. We went to war with Spain, they said, to free Cuba from its colonial masters, not to make ourselves masters of the Philippines.
Republican Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts led the Senate fight for the treaty. The opposition was led by the other Massachusetts senator, George Hoar, also a Republican. Senator Lodge appealed to national pride. He urged the Senate not to pull down the American flag. Rejection of the treaty, he said, would dishonor the president and the country. It would show that we are not ready as a nation to enter into great questions of foreign policy. Senator Albert Beveridge of Ohio also spoke in support of the treaty. Senator Beveridge said the Pacific would be of great importance in coming years. Therefore, he said, the power that rules the Pacific will be the power that rules the world. And with the Philippines, that power is and forever will be the United States.
Senator Hoar spoke strongly against the treaty. He said that taking over the Philippines would be a dangerous break with America's past. He said the greatest thing the United States had was its tradition of freedom. To take the Philippines, he said, would deny that tradition. It would violate the Constitution and the ideas contained in the Declaration of Independence. The idea that all men are created equal, and that government exists only with the permission of the governed.
The Senate vote on the treaty was set for February 6th. It seemed that the opposition had enough votes to reject it. But several things happened before the vote. William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the Democratic Party, opposed the takeover of the Philippines. But he urged Democratic senators to vote for the treaty. Bryan was looking ahead to the presidential election in 1900. He believed that the Philippines takeover would cause the United States nothing but trouble. He could put the blame for all the trouble on the Republicans. Then, if he was elected president, the Democrats could give the Philippines their independence. Bryan succeeded in getting 17 Democrats and populists in the Senate to vote for the treaty.
2 days before the vote was taken, violence broke out in the Philippines. President McKinley, without waiting for the Senate to act, ordered the American military government in Manila to extend its control throughout the Philippines. The leader of the Philippine rebels, Emilio Aquinaldo, opposed the order. Rebel forces prepared to fight. On the night of February 4th, 30,000 rebels attacked American forces around Manila. 60 Americans were killed, and more than 270 were wounded. Rebel losses were much higher.
News of the rebel attack caused some senators to change their minds about the Philippines. Some who had opposed the treaty now agreed with the Washington Star newspaper that the Filipinos must be taught to obey. 84 senators were present for the vote on the treaty. To pass, the treaty needed a two-thirds majority, 56 votes. One by one, the senators voted. Then the count was announced. 57 of the lawmakers had voted yes. Only 27 had voted no. The treaty was approved. The Philippines belonged to the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.